Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
This is DW's Africa Link program, coming to you straight from our studios here in Bonn, Germany. I'm Isaac Mugabe, your host.
And my name is Jen Yinge. Glad you could join us.
On the program today, Angolans head to the polls tomorrow in an election that will see President José Eduardo dos Santos quit after nearly four decades in power. We hear from a correspondent.
The capital, Luanda, and I suppose the country in general is very calm, speaking with people on the streets, asking what they expect from these elections. Almost everyone answers that he wants change.
Flights resume at Juba Airport in South Sudan after a dispute between the United Nations mission and the government. But why the dispute?
We should know what they are bringing into the country in terms of organic weapons, in terms of personal rifles.
These are some of the stories, and there is much more to come that we've lined up for you. But first, let's hear what's been happening around the world.
This is Natalie Muller with GW News. An alleged member of a terror cell accused of carrying out last week's deadly attacks in Spain has told a court the group had been planning a much larger attack. The testimony came from Mohamed Huli Chemlal, one of four men detained over the vehicle attacks in Barcelona and Cambrils, which left 15 people dead and more than 120 wounded. The four are believed to be the only survivors of the 12-man cell. On Monday, police shot dead Yunus Abu Yaqub, the alleged driver of the van that ploughed into crowds on Barcelona's Las Ramblas Boulevard. Afghanistan has welcomed US President Donald Trump's plan to deploy thousands more troops to the war-torn country. Before running for president, Trump had called for a speedy withdrawal from Afghanistan, but in a speech on Monday, he promised to ramp up the military campaign against the Taliban. Trump also used the address to accuse Pakistan of harboring terrorists. Speaking to troops in Kandahar, Afghan President Ashraf Ghani described the plan as a welcome boost for local forces.
Today is a special day because a few hours ago the United States President delivered his speech. I hope that you've all heard it. His message was that after this, there's no limited time or conditions on their support for Afghanistan. America will stand with Afghanistan until the end.
The Angolan ruling party's presidential candidate, João Lourenço, has dismissed the idea that he would share power if elected. Angolan voters go to the polls on Wednesday in an election that will see President José Eduardo dos Santos step down after almost four decades in power. His party, the MLPA, is expected to win and to install Lourenço as head of state. Responding to concerns, dos Santos will continue to wield influence behind the scenes. Lourenço vowed to rule alone and to fight graft if elected. This news comes to you from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. India's Supreme Court has banned a controversial Muslim law that allows men to instantly divorce their wives. The panel of judges ruled that the so-called triple talaq practice was unconstitutional, un-Islamic, and a violation of the right to equality. Sakia Soman from the Indian Women's Movement hailed the change as a victory for gender justice.
It's a very happy day for us. It's a historic day. I wouldn't say that it ends here. In fact, a proper, longer battle for social reform, for empowerment, for awareness, for education has to be, taken up.
The United Nations says the Nigerian militant group Boko Haram has increased its use of child bombers fourfold this year compared to all of 2016. UNICEF reported that 83 children had been sent out as human bombs since the start of 2017, most of them girls under the age of 15. The UN said the tactic resulted in many kids who managed to escape from the group later being rejected by their communities. Boko Haram's Islamic insurgency in northeastern Nigeria has killed 20,000 people and displaced around 1.7 million since 2009. And finally, in South Africa, trade union Solidarity says it has reached an agreement for wage increases with engineering and steel industry employers, allaying fears of a possible strike. They reportedly agreed to a wage hike of between 6.5% and 7%. For more news, you can visit our website, dw.com. I'm Natalie Muller.
Welcome once again to the program. My name is Isaac Mugabe.
And I'm Jane Nyingi.
We begin today's program in Angola, where the country is bracing itself for an election that will see President José Eduardo dos Santos quit after nearly four decades in power. Dos Santos has laid the groundwork for a hand-picked successor, João Lourenço, in an oil-rich country where corruption and human rights concerns are unlikely to dissipate anytime soon. Lourenço today said he will have all the power and there will be one president. Shortly before we came on air, I spoke to DW's Antonio Kashkei in Luanda, and he started by telling me the mood in the country.
One day before the elections, the capital, Luanda, and I suppose the country in general is very calm, speaking with people on the streets, asking what they expect from these elections. Almost everyone answers that he wants change, more work, better health care, more and better schooling, less poverty. Some of the people think this change could come out of the ruling MPLA party. But for other people, this is not enough. They want the MPLA out of power and prefer one of the opposition candidates.
Is there a feeling that Angolans have braced themselves for new leadership after long-serving President Dos Santos is gone?
Yes, João Lourenço invited some international journalists to speak with him in the party headquarters today, and I was there representing DW Africa, and in fact, the first question was whether he himself will control the power in the country in case he wins the elections, or whether José Eduardo dos Santos, the former president, will remain at least until the next year the president of the MPLA party, and if he will be the strong man in Angola. And let's listen to what Lourenço said. He said, in fact, that he will be the only one president of the state, and this president will be João Lourenço. People will elect one only president and not two. That's the words of João Lourenço. Other observers don't agree with the words of Lourenço. They say that, in fact, Dos Santos and Dos Santos' family will remain in power. And don't forget that Dos Santos' decisions concerning the leaders of the security, of the military and the police forces will not be touched, and that his daughter, Isabel Dos Santos, is running the state-owned oil company Sonangol, while his son, Zenu Dos Santos, is having the state-owned sovereign oil funds of Angola, which is worth $5 to $6 billion.
That is DW's Portuguese service, Antonio Kashkei in Luanda.
And Isaac, this is a report that has created a lot of talk on social media platforms. And when I look at our Facebook page, Odeyemi from Nigeria says, so sad, a rich, promising country has not lived up to its potential, all because of international conspiracy, war, and plain greed. I hope the people will rewrite history by massive participation in the election.
Abdurrahman Ademola from Nigeria also says, I wish the Angolan people a successful poll.
We have this one from Abdurrahman. He's also from Nigeria, and he says, I wish the Angolan people a successful poll.
Lilwano Ibrahim says, stepping down of Angolan president after 38 years ruling is a great opportunity to the youth of that country. We are calling for Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe to take a better lesson from that great president. Keep your comments coming. Where I write is DW Africa. That's our Facebook page.
And now we take you to Iran, which has threatened to resume the production of high-level uranium enrichment within 5 days if the United States revokes the nuclear deal struck by world powers in 2015. The deal was championed by Iranian President Hassan Rouhani, together with the United States, Russia, China, and three European powers, which led to the lifting of most sanctions against Iran in return for curbing its nuclear ambition. Rodo Odhiambo with the details.
Iranian President Rouhani has intensified efforts to protect the deal against Washington's return to an aggressive Iran policy after U.S. President Donald Trump approved new sanctions on Tehran. Rouhani also issued a warning letter last week that Iran could abandon the nuclear agreement if the U.S. had imposed sanctions. Ali Akbar Saleh, head of Iran's atomic energy, says they are not bending the knee on the deal.
If we have the determination to do so, we are able to resume 20% enrichment within a few days, in at most 5 days at the underground nuclear site. This is very meaningful for those who are technically familiar with the subject. They get the message well.
Trump repeatedly threatened to tear up the nuclear deal during his campaign. It has come under mounting pressure after Iran carried out missile tests and Washington imposed new sanctions, with each accusing the other of violating the spirit of the agreement. Salehi also says the new U.S. sanctions breach the deal.
We are capable of surprising the West if we want to, and it will be on them. However, we do not want to see such a day.
The U.S. Treasury imposes sanctions on 6 Iranian firms in late July for their role in the development of a ballistic missile program after Tehran launched a rocket capable of putting a satellite into orbit.
Rodo Odhiambo with that report from Iran.
And Jason Rosenthal says, let's see if the great negotiator in inverted commas, that is the president of the United States, Donald Trump, can prevent the Iran nuclear deal from falling apart. He put a hashtag on that, to be specific. And let's go back to Africa for a while. Flights have resumed at South Sudan's main airport in the capital, Juba, after a standoff between the government and the United Nations Rapid Protection Force that has been deployed in the country to maintain peace and security. The UN troops attempted to illegally occupy the Juba airport without any formal agreement with the administration. It's not the first time the government in Juba and the UN troops disagree on methods of operations. From Nairobi, James Shimanyula sent this report.
The presence of 4,000 soldiers of the United Nations Rapid Protection Force at the Juba International Airport angered South Sudan's administration. But the head of the United Nations mission in the country, David Shearer, explains why the force should remain at the airport.
The reason, because we have many flights going in and out and around the country, delivering humanitarian goods and peacekeepers.
The Rapid Protection Force is mandated by the United Nations to protect the airport and ensure that it remains operational. The UN also protects strategic installations in the country, including the Juba Airport. South Sudan Deputy Military Spokesman Brigadier General Lal Ruai Koang has this assertion.
We should know what they are bringing into the country in terms of organic weapons, in terms of personal rifles.
South Sudan Information Minister Michael Makuei reflects on unilateral pitching of camp by the UN force.
They came and they put up there, and now we don't know why did they decide to go to airport site. If you are a guest coming to my house, you are supposed to ask me where you will put up, but you don't come and choose where to put up or where to sleep.
Jacob Chuol, professor of political science at the Juba University, acknowledges that the United Nations operates flights that deliver humanitarian aid to the needy throughout South Sudan. However, Chuol contends that the newly deployed Rapid Protection Force has its limits to the country's sensitive places.
The argument of the government is that the airport is a sovereign thing. It belongs to the government of the day, and therefore that should be left to the government as exclusive power of the government to protect.
That report was compiled by James Shimanyula in Nairobi. Now, Jen, this is a story that when you look at, you know, social media platforms, there's a problem of communication between the UN on one hand and the South Sudanese government in Juba about their modus operandi, if I may say.
Absolutely.
Just to remind our listeners, the United Nations Rapid Protection Force was put in place or was agreed upon by the SADC meeting and supposed to protect the people, civilians and security in the whole of South Sudan. And for them, they thought, you know, having the Juba airport as one of their bases, it would make it their flights much easier. But as we've had in that report, it wasn't the case. You know, the government is livid about it.
But I think this is an issue of trust. Maybe both sides are not trusting each other. The government is not trusting.
They've always had these clashes, you know, misunderstandings. Anyway, we shall keep monitoring the story whenever we can. In case you've just joined us, this is DW's Africa Link program, live from our studios here in Bonn, Germany. My name is Isaac Mugabe.
And I'm Jane Nyinge. And you, if you have anything to tell us, please leave your comments on our Facebook page. And you can also as well leave us a voice note on our WhatsApp. And now, going to the second part of the program, pregnant mothers in Kenya's coastal town of Mombasa receive tricycle ambulances that will be used to transport them to hospital for safe deliveries.
During my labor pains, doctors tried to help me, but they noticed that my high blood pressure was rising very fast. So they took me inside a tricycle ambulance.
In Ghana, the latest statistics show that in the first half of this year, 57,000 teenage girls have become pregnant. Maristops, an international family planning organization which released the numbers, said this has been due to lack of sex education among the young people. A sexual reproductive health forum is underway in the town of Tamale, and our reporter Maxwell Suk managed to speak to some teenage mothers.
I want to go to school. I don't want my
own. Al-Hassan Afisa will be 17 years in 3 days, but she is already 8 months pregnant. She is among thousands of teenage girls in Ghana, many of whom have been forced to stay with men responsible for the pregnancies.
When I got pregnant, my parents said I should come and stay with the guy, but I don't like it down.
She says the pregnancy caught her off guard.
I didn't know how to protect myself from getting pregnant. Otherwise, I wouldn't be pregnant. I would have loved to go to school. The guy who got me pregnant also doesn't know how to protect himself because there are no health insurance. That is why we young people get pregnant.
Nafisa's predicament is widespread in Ghana. According to the Maristos International, a family planning giant, 57,000 teenage girls got pregnant in the first half of 2017 alone across the country due to lack of sex education. Tamara Suleimana works with the Northern Sector Advocacy and Awareness Center, NORSAC, a gender-based organization helping women and young girls.
The young people we have today are sexually active. And if they are sexually active, what information is available for them to be able to say, I will protect myself and will not get pregnant? If they do not have access to those information, now if they even have the information and the services are not available for them to access it and use it and protect themselves, then we will continue to have the rise in teenage pregnancy.
Please make sure you use a contraceptive and know that even if you are using the contraceptive, it won't prevent you from getting it or any sexually transmitted disease.
A group of curious teenage girls surrounds a midwife at a round table at the auditorium of the Tamale Girls Secondary School. They are discussing sexual reproductive health rights. The forum is held to examine issues that affect young women's growth in the region. Hafsat Uriza is among the young girls in attendance, and she explains what has made them vulnerable.
There is a significant number of unfriendly health care services providers who push young people away from the health centers, leaving us vulnerable to peer misguidance. Yet, nothing is done to health care providers who deny young people services or are not friendly to them when they visit health centers. Safe abortion services are unaffordable, hence increasing the rate of risk and unsafe abortions.
To solve such problems, the Ghana Health Service in the region has mounted pressure on health facilities to remove all barriers affecting access to health information by young people. And some midwives, like Rebecca Azuma, have started implementing some of the initiatives.
We are also on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, all the social media, we are there. And we have given them their handles so that if they want any information, they can go into those areas, type in whatever information they have, and they will get somebody to give them the right information.
That was Maxwell Suk in Tamale, Ghana.
We have some of your comments on this story. Johnson from Ghana says, in northern Ghana, it's because of their culture. Child marriage is allowed, and that's why teenage pregnancies is too high there.
We have Adidas from Rwanda. I don't know if you come from the same village with him. He says teenage pregnancies could be reduced by educating girls and boys about reproduction and give concrete explanations to what they do not understand.
Well, yes. In Rwanda, we do a lot of sensitization about underage sex and, of course, child marriages, not forgetting even child pregnancies. Azza Godwin, writing from Liberia, says teenage pregnancy is rampant not only in northern Ghana, but many countries in the West African region. These girls are not taught sexual education due to the parents fearing that it might corrupt their mind. But the fact is that these children are more involved and exposed to sexual activity.
And we have John, who comes from my home country, Kenya, and he says the man should pay for the child support. And if he fails, his property is sold to cater for the child's needs.
Abayomi from Nigeria says in northern Ghana, with all seriousness, the men there should be castrated. That's a strong one. Anyway, keep those comments flowing. We will read them whenever we can, when we have time. Just live here on Africa Link.
Africa on the move.
Now, in a related development, pregnant mothers living in informal settlements in Mombasa on the Kenyan coast have a reason to smile after an international organization came to their aid by donating tricycle ambulances. They are now able to get the hospital on time to deliver or when they develop complications. Many lives have been saved, both for mothers and babies. From Mombasa, Diana Wanyonyi reports.
In Kenya, tricycles, commonly known as tuk-tuks, are widely used as public service vans that carry 3 to 4 passengers per trip. But in Mombasa County, Kenya's second capital city, a non-governmental organization known as the Women and Health Alliance, WAHA, has changed the mindset of many by modifying them into ambulances. At the Junda dispensary, which received one of the tricycle ambulances, I met Mariam Bashora, who had just delivered her third child inside the tricycle ambulance while she was being taken to the Coast General Referral Hospital.
During my labor pains, doctors tried to help me, but they noticed that my high blood pressure was rising very fast. So they took me inside a tricycle ambulance that was donated by WAHA to transport me to Coast General Referral Hospital so as to save my life. On my way to the referral hospital, I delivered my baby safely inside the tricycle ambulance with the help of two nurses. They then took me to the Coast General Hospital for further medical observation. I never knew in my life that one day I'll be carried by ambulance to go to hospital to deliver. In fact, I knew that I had to have a lot of money for me to use ambulance services.
Seated next to her in a queue at the dispensary is Mwanatumu Bwanamku, nursing her fourth-born baby boy. This is the only baby she has delivered in a health facility, thanks to the tuk-tuk ambulance services that saved both mother and child.
I am grateful that the tuk-tuk ambulance were donated. I gave birth to all my children at home with the help of traditional birth attendants. But the fourth pregnancy gave me a lot of problems. I bled for 2 days during my labor pains, and the child couldn't come out. I was taken to the hospital by the tricycle ambulance, where I gave birth safely. I'm urging expectant mothers to always go to health facilities for medical assistance.
The tricycle ambulances provide services free of charge. Boris Wambua is the project coordinator at WAHA, a non-profit organization committed to offering comprehensive healthcare services to impoverished communities and persons, giving priorities to those who are most vulnerable, especially women and children. He explains more about this European Union-funded program in Mombasa.
Our main objective is to reduce the morbidity and mortality of mothers and children under 5. These tricycle ambulances are meant to ensure that there is prompt referral from the community to the facility. And if there is any case from the primary facility to the tertiary facility for specialized treatment for mothers and children under 5 years.
Despite its simplicity and low maintenance costs, demands for the tuk-tuk ambulances remains high, and expectant mothers are only hoping that the Waha project will able to supply more so that expectant mothers can forget about delivering from their homes and instead go to the hospital.
Dana Wanyonyi with that report.
Focus Europe.
After more than 150 years, the world's most famous clock bell that rang out across Parliament Square in London has fallen silent. Big Ben was turned off on Monday noon for essential repairs and will remain silent for a period of 4 years. From London, Stephen Baird reports.
Resonant and reassuring, the great bell has rung out from the clock tower at the north end of the Houses of Parliament since 1859. But the old clock is in urgent need of repair and renovation. The iconic chimes will have to be silenced, says Big Ben mechanic Ian Westworth, to save the hearing of the workers throughout this lengthy process.
It's a huge task because it's the whole tower's been looked at, not just the bells and the clock mechanism. We're going to silence the bells, and this will be for health and safety of the scaffolders and the people working in the tower.
And then, he says, early next year, the whole clock mechanism will have to be dismantled. The bells have been taken out of action before, but this time it's causing widespread dismay because the plan is to switch off these world-famous chimes for a period of 4 years. Lord Dobbs is a member of the House of Lords and author of the political thriller The House of Cards. It was turned into a highly successful Netflix drama of the same name. Big Ben, he says, is an enduring symbol of Britain.
It's a great source of comfort there and a sense of security. It's defied so many things, fire, frost, even packs of starlings. When the House of Commons burnt to the ground in 1941, the Big Ben was still there ringing out, showing the clock face. It is a huge, important part of our national lives.
Now over to Westminster, hopefully, for the chimes of Big Ben.
Britain's state-owned broadcaster, the BBC, will certainly miss the bell. The corporation uses it live to introduce 2 daily radio bulletins. When Big Ben was out of commission in 1976, the BBC was forced to resort to an alternative.
Next, the news read by Peter Donaldson. And usually at this time we bring you the chimes of Big Ben, but as you probably know, it's out of action. So instead, here are the chimes of Big Tom from St Paul's Cathedral.
Not quite the resonance listeners have been used to. Tourists are going to miss Big Ben too. In fact, they've already started to complain about the scaffolding that's going up, obscuring most of the tower.
Big Ben is Big Ben, and people want to see Big Ben, not half a Ben, a full Ben.
That would definitely be a bummer, for sure, to come all the way here and not to be able to see it.
Adam Watrobsky, the architect who's supervising the renovation, dismisses these complaints.
You have to look at the advantages. If we're going to secure the tower for future generations, that far outweighs the inconvenience of having scaffolding up for 2 or 3 years.
But it's the loss of the bell for 4 years that's causing the biggest repercussions. Even members of Parliament are asking whether the members of the parliamentary committees that authorised the work have dropped a clanger. Lawmaker Nigel Evans.
A number of them didn't know when they were passing off these works that Big Ben would fall silent for 4 years. And a couple of the MPs on these committees have already said that. And it seems to suggest to me that maybe the questions weren't properly asked, or indeed the experts weren't forthcoming.
Parliament will now reconsider the time span of the renovation work and whether the workmen can simply be issued with earmuffs to protect their hearing.
That was Stephen Baird in London.
And as you've heard in that report, many emotions, Jen, about Big Ben, stopping. And Daniel Jenks says, members of parliament having a minute's silence for a clock compared to most other things, state of this country.
A user by name Teacher Dude says, 4 years to change a battery is a bit much It's a bit much.
And Malcolm Wood says Big Ben is the very heart of the UK, indeed the Commonwealth. Our MPs have stopped it from ringing. Many thanks for your comments. And with that, we come to the end of the program. On behalf of the production crew, I'm Isaac Mugabe.
And my name is Jen Nyinge. Thank you so much for your time.